Welcome to EJB Talks, Rutgers Blaustein School experts in policy, planning, and health, where we talk with our faculty and staff experts, as well as students, about how the fields of public policy, urban planning, public health, health administration, and public and urban informatics affect your lives. Welcome to EJB Talks. I'm Stuart Shapiro, the Associate Dean of Faculty at the Blaustein School, and the purpose of this podcast is to highlight the work my colleagues and our alumni in the fields of policy, planning, and health are doing to make the world, the country, and New Jersey a better place. In our continuing series of talking with recently retired and retiring faculty, today I'm honored to be speaking with distinguished Professor Mike Greenberg. Mike used to hold my job as associate dean and has also served as the interim dean of the school. It would take a long time to sum up everything Mike's done, but in short, I'll just say there's little at the Blaustein School that Mike hasn't done in his career here. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So let's go back to your origin story here. How did you end up at the Blaustein School?
Well, I always wanted to be at Columbia University, and so I got a job at Columbia University. Unfortunately, the dean at that time decided that the subjects I was interested in were not interesting to him. And so he told me after a year I would never get tenure at Columbia. So I was recruited by Rutgers and came to Rutgers. Notably, the same dean, who's now deceased, apologized to me publicly at a meeting, saying he made a mistake.
Well, Columbia's loss was our gain, that's for sure. So really, more than anyone, I think, in my time at Blaustein School, you've championed the idea that public health, urban planning, and policy are really all pieces of a greater whole. Why do you feel that way? Why do you feel they all really do belong together in the same school?
As you know, I was brought up in the South Bronx, about a 10-minute walk from Yankee Stadium, with a population density of about 80,000 people per square mile. And this was a working class neighborhood. And when people needed help, they didn't care what stovepipe you were in, they just wanted help. So for me, yes, there's a field called public health, there's a field called health administration, there's a field called planning, there's a field called policy, there's a lot of different fields. So I always came at it from the point of view, it's our responsibility to put together a really good set of faculty who can address, as speakers and as researchers, topics that really people care about, which means building multidisciplinary, interconnected programs and people. That's where it came from.
That's great. And I will tell viewers that Mike's proximity to Yankee Stadium means that we spend much of our time at the Blaustein School, Mike and I, talking about the Yankees, but we're not gonna bother all of you with that. One area where these disciplines do come together is a subject you and I have worked on together. Can you talk about your history with the National Environmental Protection Act?
Yeah, I was around then. And when Richard Nixon signed the act, I thought it was a joke. I didn't believe it. First of all, the United States, which epitomized capitalism, actually making a statement talking about considering environmental protection in making decisions. And the fact that Nixon, a Republican, then put several other Republicans in charge of the Council on Environmental Quality, established the EPA with a Republican in charge of it, I was completely shocked. I'll put it that way. I had a 6-month period of shock believing that this was real, that this was actually happening. So that's where it started. Earlier, 5 to 6 years earlier, a lot of people, including myself, were working on a lot of the issues. But to have the U.S. federal government come out, make this statement, require environmental impact statements, and write a preface to the National Environmental Policy Act, which is mostly the definition that most of us use for sustainability, it was a stunner for me back then.
So can you talk a little bit about what the Act does and how it has changed the way we think about environment as we make policy?
The Act really has two significant parts to it. The first part is a very, very short preface. which essentially defines that the United States federal government is now on record as saying that environmental protection and sustainability, which of course they didn't call back then, but environmental protection and sustainability are an objective for the United States federal government. That is a critical part. But the implementation is a part that you and I have worked on a lot, as have other people. So the United States set forth a regulatory process in which if you were proposing something of significance at the federal level, if you were getting a permit from the federal government, and about five or six other things, the actions that you wanted to take, if you were proposing to take these actions, you had to do an environmental impact statement, which in essence says you have to figure out what is the action you're proposing, what are some alternative actions that you could take, what would be the environmental impact of these actions, and what could you do to mitigate those effects that you were going to produce. And this worked its way through the court system, has many, many court hours of interpretation of what's required and what's required. But the essence of it is, hey, we're the United States government, and now we are going on record as saying that consideration of environmental protection is important to us.
Why is that such a big deal? Why is that, you know, in a way, almost revolutionary?
At the time, it was revolutionary because nobody did it. Mm-hmm. So the United States environmental protection policy put forth in this act has been emulated by over 100 other countries. And it is probably the single most emulated piece of legislation ever written in the history of the United States. So for today, everyone assumes that it's there, but it wasn't there back in 1970.
And now we'll fast forward to the present, and it picks up on that point. I mean, people assume it wasn't there. There was a sort of real effort by the Trump administration to seriously change the implementation of NEPA. Can you talk a little bit about that attempt?
Sure. Basically, the Trump administration decided that NEPA was an attorney's full employment act. And what would happen is when somebody would propose something that environmental groups did not like, the environmental groups would argue against it, take it to court, and a project with the Trump administration decided should take 2 years, could still be in the courts and still being battled on for 5 years, 10 years, and in several cases, you know, even 20 years. And so they put out essentially a hit on NEPA, and they were proposing radical changes, that things had to be done within a couple of years, they had to be done with minimum challenges, you couldn't bring in new topics like sustainability, and they really were taking a hatchet to it. And although I know and you know that the act and the law and the regulations needed some revision, there have been revisions occurring for many, many years. Yet they weren't satisfied. They were going to just axe it.
So it's not as if NEPA really couldn't be improved, but the problem is that, as you said, there was a hatchet being used when really a scalpel was probably what's necessary.
Yes, I agree. Scalpel's the right word, yeah.
I mean, what are some of the things you would fix about NEPA?
Well, I think that because some of the proposals take so many years to build, it's a little unfair to have something approved under one presidency and 4 years later, you get a new president. The new president decides he or she doesn't like it, and so they stop it after some company or some other government has already spent billions of dollars in investments. So it's the leaving people hang out there is very, very troubling to me. Second, I do think that the documents, which originally was supposed to be hundreds of pages long, started to become 1,000 pages long, and really were not providing all the information that was needed to make a decision. They were providing so much information, too much information, people got drowned in numbers.
Yeah, now that's one of my bugaboos about the act as well, is that what's happened is we get these impenetrable documents, and if NEPA is supposed to help transparency, a 1,000-page document does not help transparency.
Yeah, I mean, I just to give the listeners a sense. I wrote about 150-page piece of a NEPA document. The document was so thick, it was about a nuclear power plant, that they had to wheel it in on one of the old-fashioned library carts. That's how big it was. It was thousands and thousands of pages long.
Yeah, indeed. I want to turn to another issue, which probably will resonate with some of our younger viewers, the issue of environmental justice. Can you talk a little bit about how a school like the Blaustein School that incorporates policy planning and health is really kind of fit to deal with environmental justice, and how a good dealing with environmental justice requires all of those perspectives?
There's nothing really simple about environmental justice. It's actually quite complicated. And in order to study something properly, you need people that understand ethics. You need people that understand science issues, social science issues, issues around sociology, issues around land use planning. It really is, the whole idea of environmental justice fits the Blaustein School very, very well. We have a lot of multidisciplinary, deep thinking faculty, and we're a really perfect group to work on it.
And where do you see sort of our national dialogue in environmental justice going in the next couple of years? I mean, the Biden administration has talked about making it a priority. What do you think is going to happen?
Depends who the next president is, but during these next few years while Biden is president, you can expect intensification of requirements for U.S. federal agencies in order to receive funding, and you can expect the Biden administration to tell federal agencies like the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, and others that they have to accomplish certain environmental justice-related tasks. And as you know, I've been working on that for the Department of Energy, working on it right now and been working on it for the last few months.
So is it fair to say, as much as NEPA kind of forced agencies to think more about the environment and incorporate it into their decisions, what the Biden administration hopes we see in the years ahead is incorporating environmental justice into more government decisions?
That's true, and it's actually happening right now. I mean, as we're speaking, this is happening.
Well, that's encouraging. It's always nice to see the things we talk about in the classroom move out into the real world there.
I can give some examples of that.
Yeah, please do. Right,
so you're a big organization like the Department of Defense or Department of Energy, and the Biden administration tells them that they have to start environmental justice programs at some of their locations. And so one of the things I've been helping the Energy Department with is at its very large locations, what is the on-the-ground evidence that we have that they have environmental justice and social justice issues in the area? So I've been doing and just gave them a report that we did on environmental and social justice challenges at the Department of Energy sites.
And that presumably will lead to or will influence decisions on those sites.
We'll see. I mean, they have to make a choice as to what places they want to emphasize, what communities near their sites they want to emphasize. And they're working on this right now. The last talk I had with them was last Friday.
So let's kind of, as a wrap up, think back to your time at Blaustein. It's obviously been a long time. What do you look back at most fondly? What are you most proud of?
Well, I think Blaustein, what it was before it was called Blaustein, has given me an opportunity to kind of live out a dream of how I like to do things. And I think you've been asking me about that. Basically, I am a real believer in working with people from different disciplines, all of whom are very smart, but you put their brains together and they become exponentially smarter. It's amazing how this works. So I'm very pleased the way it's worked out. And this may sound a little corny, but the reality is, when I was associate dean and then dean for a short period of time, hiring people like you, watching you develop and watching you all succeed and move up in prestige, both within Rutgers, but especially nationally, that's a total blast for me. And as I said to the students and the faculty, I get to brag about all of your accomplishments. It's wonderful for me. I love it.
Well, there's not anyone, any faculty member, including the many we've talked to on this podcast, who doesn't owe a debt of gratitude to Dean Greenberg there. And both his, of course, hiring and mentoring of us, and also his example of bringing the kind of work he does in his research out to the real world in the way that, that he's described there. So thanks, Mike, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Stuart. Go Yankees.
Yeah, no, that's an editorial comment I'm going to allow to stay in there. So a big thanks to Mike, and of course also to our production team, Amy Cobb and Karen Olson. We'll see you next week with another talk from another expert at the Blaustein School. Until then, stay safe.